this country is at war with Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello, listener. Welcome to the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. I have something slightly different for you. On the back of episode 87, when I talked to Robert Forsyth about the war in North Africa, I thought it might be interesting to see how that fighting is interpreted and simulated as a computer game, and look at the choices games designers have to make juggling authenticity over entertainment. I'm joined by David Milne from Relic Entertainment. David is one of the senior designers who worked on Company of Heroes 3, a computer game which focuses on World War II in North Africa and Italy. David, thanks for joining me. And for people unfamiliar with Company of Heroes, and we are going to be specifically talking about the latest version, what is your elevator pitch to explain it?
Company of Heroes is a real-time strategy game based on World War II battles. So if you're not familiar with a real-time strategy game, it's sort of that more God's eye view, right? You're looking down at the battlefield from above. You're building up your base. You're building your armies. You're commanding your troops, you know, to get into cover and to capture objectives and ultimately to defeat your enemy. And you're doing that while playing through, you know, sort of these historical campaigns. Company of Heroes 3 focuses on the invasion of Italy. So moving from the south of Italy and, you know, from Salerno and making your way up to Rome. And then North Africa focuses on the German Africa Corps starting at Ajdabaya and ending up at El Alamein.
Which sounds fantastic. What scale are we playing at? So are you talking about vast tank battles, or are we talking sort of platoon skirmish, or?
Kind of true to the name, I suppose it kind of lands between platoon and company size, sort of, right? It's, you know, you're going to, it is a Company of Heroes, I suppose. But, you know, if you think about it, your average game will have, say, 5 to 7 or 8 infantry squads, you know, 3 or 4 tanks, a couple of weapons teams, like a, you know, like a heavy machine gun section or an anti-tank gun, that kind of thing. So it's, you know, you're thinking 10 to 15 squads or vehicles, you know, at any given time. So it's bigger than a platoon, but, you know, a company with armored support, maybe, is sort of the size.
That's a good way of putting it. So why did you end up with Sicily in the Mediterranean theater? I've got so many questions bumbling around my head. Why did you end up with Sicily in North Africa?
In our previous games, you know, so Company of Heroes 1 was focused very much on the Western Front. The invasion of Normandy expansions that came out included Market Garden and sort of more kind of final pushes into Germany from that Western side. Company of Heroes 2, based entirely on the Eastern Front. We actually did poll our kind of longtime players to see, you know, sort of what they wanted, and they kind of agreed that this seemed more interesting. And, you know, from our perspective, I think that we're bringing something new. You know, I think a lot of games do focus on that, you know, D-Day, the invasion of Normandy aspect of things. And, you know, we wanted to be able to bring in, you know, an earlier war perspective, which opens up a lot of options for us. One, it's a new story, but we also get to focus on more early war tanks and vehicles and atmosphere and that sort of a thing. So yeah, it seemed to make sense, you know, kind of given our history and lined up with what the players want. And so that's what we went with.
Mediterranean is kind of cool because you've got the Germans, the British, the Italians. There's a lot thrown in there. There's the Commonwealth troops.
Exactly. There's a lot sort of coming together there. I mean, both in terms of just all the factions that were involved, but also in kind of the attitude of the Allies at that point. There was kind of this, like, you know, they're starting at either sides of North Africa and they meet in the middle, and you're literally, they're coming together at that point and kind of shaking out what that, you know, alliance really means in practice, you know, before they get to Western Europe.
Now, you mentioned before about the story. Is there a narrative when you played? Are you playing the narrative of the campaign?
So in Italy, we have what we're calling our dynamic campaign map. And so I said, you know, each mission you're playing more at that company level, we'll say. But between the missions, you actually have this giant map of Italy that you're moving your companies around on. So you're acting much more like a theater commander at that point, where you're thinking about things like, you know, whether your companies are in or out of supply. Like, you're thinking about more kind of the logistics and the grand strategy of moving your companies around. And then when you engage with an enemy company or engage at a city where a battle will be fought, that's when you go down to that company level and you're controlling your squads at that more tactical level. So in the Italian campaign, there is sort of the general historical idea, and we base it on the history of you're starting at Salerno, you're trying to break your way through, you know, the winter line, the Gustav line, you know, you can kind of, but at the same time, the player has agency, right? They can kind of choose. And so we set up the historical precedent, but then in some ways it's a little bit up to the player whether or not they're going to follow that historical precedent, right? Because we can't control what decisions they make or what battles they win or lose. And so it kind of draws, I think, from the core of wargaming in general, which is the what if question. What if I was here? What if I was the commander? What if I was making these decisions? And so the setup is based on that history. But once the ball gets kind of rolling, it may or may not end up being, you know, kind of in line with the actual history of what's going on. Although the individual missions themselves, again, we base that on that history, you know, of the battle itself, and again, try to give the player that feeling that you are here and you are fighting these battles.
When you've canvassed, sort of, you know, I presume you've done market research, you know, all when you've been doing games one and two, you'll have some idea. You know, the war was now a long time ago, and I'm quite conscious of, certainly when I talk to younger people than myself, they don't necessarily have the direct connection with the war. How much do you need to explain what was happening in the war? Because certainly, as you said, people have some idea about D-Day, some idea about Market Garden. But certainly when you're looking at the Mediterranean theatre, there's, you know, people's ideas of what that is a bit more patchy.
We certainly are giving the player as much information as we can at any given point. But we do also focus, you know, there are characters as well in our game, you know, so there are people who are talking to you. There are generals whose personalities you kind of have to manage on that campaign layer. And of course, you know, more to the ground, you know, your angel on your shoulder, talking head Joe Conte is there to give you kind of that soldier's perspective as well. And so as much as we focus on the history, one of the things that we really want to focus on is people and character. It's not just companies moving around on a map. This is about people who are fighting this war and really trying to focus in on those aspects of it as well.
When you're starting to, you know, drill down into those people, is it possible to, I was going to say, how much can you research the tactics of the time, and is it sort of possible to play those out, or have you built in certain aspects of the tactics and doctrine at the time to play out?
We certainly try to. So each of our companies, so you can choose either American companies or British companies, and within that, there are options. So we have an airborne company for the Americans. We have an armored company. We have a special forces company, which is based on that first special forces, that joint Canadian-American force as well. And then for the British, you know, we've got an Indian artillery company and British armored. And so we definitely try to give the player these different options. And then once you get into that, that changes what you have access to. Of course, if you're the American airborne, you've got your paratroopers and you've got, you know, the ability to drop, you know, munitions and weapons behind enemy lines so that you can kind of meet up with it rather than building things back at your base. And it gives you a much more mobile way of playing. And of course, then for the Indian artillery, for instance, you've got huge, you know, like BL 5.5 artillery emplacements that your engineers can build, and 4.2-inch mortars instead of the standard 2-inch mortar. And of course, the Gurkha assault infantry, right? So they come in and they're all equipped with Thompsons, and they're these assault infantry that you can move in. So you've kind of got this very flexible force. And then in terms of the tactics that are used, we try to do as much research as we can, certainly from the mission design side, in terms of what challenge we're giving the player. So when we think about an airfield, right, what are you going to have at an airfield? Are you going to have a lot of flak guns, right, defending it, and some more mobile troops and that sort of thing? So, you know, when you fight against one of these airfields that has a bunch of these anti-air weapons, maybe the paratroopers aren't the best, you know, force for you to bring into that. Maybe we bring the armored that time. Or, you know, for instance, in the Battle of Ortona was one of the missions that I worked on. And I found a bunch of really, really great accounts of that, and in even some descriptions of how the Germans defended intersections and how they actually positioned their machine guns and mines and infantry around an intersection in order to defend it. So when I went to making that mission, that's how I set up the enemy. I set them. So when you play Ortona and you go against one of those intersections, you're fighting against the strategy that the Germans employed to do that. And of course, it's up to you. Are you going to hit it with mortars? Are you going to bomb it? Are you going to rush in with smoke and assault infantry? It's a little more up to you, but we set it up in a way that is as authentic as kind of we can make it, while still giving the player a lot of agency and choice in how they do things.
Well, I was going to say, did you ever find after you set it up authentically and realize that actually it's really difficult and you might need to tweak it?
Yes. I'll say we use fewer mines maybe in some of the missions, because mines are extremely difficult to deal with. But yeah, and if they're invisible to you and suddenly your tank is gone, it's a little bit like, oh, well, there's 5 minutes of production time I'm not getting back.
Yeah. That's interesting how you have to slightly tweak things as you go. I was going to say that comes down to, is there a lot of that where you're trying to juggle, or how hard is it to juggle the idea of simulation between what we think is real and you know, simulacra and simulation? You know, that
it is a constant balance. I'm not going to lie to you. Because on one hand, we're trying to be as authentic as we possibly can, but it's a video game, and you know, the player has abilities and stuff. So you know, there is some suspension of disbelief you need a little bit, you know, in the idea that, you know, your artillery is on the same map that you're, you know, shooting at, which means that you're shooting, you know, this artillery has a max range of like 500 meters if you actually measure it out or something like that, which doesn't really make sense. But you gotta, you know, you gotta kind of like, we're not playing, you know, the huge, you know, massive battles. You know, this is company level, so it's got to kind of match the scale a little bit. A lot of things are really sort of scaled down in some ways. But at the same time, you know, we're not going like total, you know, in the other way of like making things up, right? You know, like there's no ray guns and stuff in that you can unlock, right? We're trying to keep it that, you know, that reality. But even just down to the idea that infantry has, you know, health as a number, right? So they can be shot multiple times before dying. So, you know, there's always some element of suspension of disbelief. It, certainly when I go back to Company of Heroes 1 is drawing a lot of inspiration from things like Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers. Extremely authentic representations of World War II, but you know, they're movies and they do movie stuff sometimes. And so like that in some ways, you know, that's kind of what we're eking out here, is this representation of World War II and trying to drive people towards the history as much as we can. But also cool explosions are cool. So we're going to do some of that every once in a while as well.
Yeah, I was saying, ultimately it's a game. It's to be enjoyed, not necessarily to be a slog.
Yeah, exactly.
So there has to be, you know,
although Ortona is a bit of a slog.
It's historical, actually, is a juggle over entertainment. So when we talk about accuracy, you've got a very, quite a big period that you're covering. So how do you, do people choose the period that they're playing in? Because not all kit will be available throughout the whole period.
So that would be another aspect of suspending disbelief a little bit. For instance, our British are based a bit more on early war. So, you know, some of their tanks are like the Valentine or the Matilda, you know, those are a couple of their tanks, and they have like a Grant as well. But then they can also, if you're the British armored, you can call in Churchills and even a Churchill Black Prince, which didn't see much action, but did exist. And so, you know, we're pulling in some things here and there. And so it's kind of, when it comes to the factions themselves, we're trying to put them in a certain period, but at the same time, because it's a game, we need to make sure that the factions, for the purpose of multiplayer, you know, when you're playing against each other, there has to be parity as well between these factions. So, you know, all the factions need to have anti-infantry options, anti-tank options, and, you know, an armored support vehicle and indirect fire. And so, you know, we theme it as much as we can, but we also need to pull certain things in to fill out an entire roster that gives the player the ability to be competitive against all other factions.
How hard is that then? Because presumably there's some quite weird mismatches when you're looking at some of the sides.
It is difficult. We have a team of gameplay designers, and I mean, that's what they have been doing for years now, is working on developing those factions, the abilities, you know, all of the units and the things that you can call in, and then balancing them all, making sure that there is some amount of parity, if not literally, you know, this tank is equal to this tank, but, you know, is this tank equal to two of these tanks? And you can build two of these tanks, and the time you can build one of these tanks, you know, so like there's, you know, it's not always symmetrical, but we need to make sure that it's balanced.
Yeah, you can't have a super weapon that somebody else just can't destroy.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, you talk there about a team of people selecting things. So do you have just military historians and sort of crossover people just sitting looking at kit and dates and working on the narrative and the...
So to some extent, that's up to us. It's up to us to do that research. If I've decided I'm going to pitch a mission for Ortona, we can go back to that. It's usually me doing a lot of that history on Ortona and trying to find what sources I can find. The Allies were really good about aerial photography as well.
So helpful.
You can get some pretty good like layouts and stuff. Yeah, it helps a lot. And a lot of photography and reading as many accounts as you can, and certainly like different accounts, because what you're kind of trying to do is find the commonalities, like find the things that you can draw out of the story that make it uniquely Ortona or uniquely Anzio or uniquely Tobruk. I mean, for example, talking about needing to suspend disbelief a little bit, the Battle of Anzio went from what, like January to June or something like that. It was a long time if you're, you know, counting all of those things. Well, our mission is 1 hour long. So, right. So like there's some element of us needing to kind of boil down that history into a representation that makes it feel like Anzio. And so when I look at those, you know, the accounts of what happened at Anzio, what's sort of standing out to me, it's the idea of a siege, right? And artillery and needing to break out. So, you know, those are the sort of things that we represent in the mission, because that's what's going to make it feel like that, even if we're not able to represent, you know, all of the weeks long, or even in some cases, months long events that happen at these battles. So the first thing you do in our mission at Anzio is you're on the beach, the artillery is coming in and waves of enemies are coming in, and you just have to hold, you're just holding the line. That's the whole thing. And so that's maybe not exactly moment by moment what happened at Anzio, but it's evoking that feeling of, you know, these guys are stuck on the beach and they are just trying to hold on, kind of a thing, right? And that's the more the emotion that we're talking about when we're trying to represent these things.
The essence of it. Yeah, play with the dynamics of the time. Now, you know, when you've like Anzio, when you've modeled this and you've got the scenario set, you've got all the men on the ground, right, let's give it a game. Have any of they surprised you at the changes that you've had to make? I mean, you mentioned mines, but are there other things that you find you've had to tweak, or you find actually that took us a lot longer, so we need to decompress or expand or change, or what surprised you?
I don't know that I could pick one thing. There's when it comes to playtesting, there's always all kinds of surprises. Usually the first pass in our missions are too hard, always. which is, you know, we have to ease things up a bit. Usually it turns out that this, I'm sure, is going to come to no surprise to you or any of your readers, but or listeners, but World War II was difficult. So it was, you know, there were real problems that needed to be solved in order to push forward. And so, yeah, so sometimes we are kind of easing up on what the defenses were and the ability of the Germans to, you know, counterattack you and that sort of a thing. Not to say that the missions aren't still challenging. We're still trying to, you know, make sure that they're challenging and engaging, but sometimes we've had to tone it down a notch. That's what I'll say. Certainly I remember Monte Cassino went through many iterations. When the designer working on that is notorious for making a hard mission, and going up that mountain on Monte Cassino is difficult in our game.
I assume when you start with these, you start with a fairly close representation of some form of historical sort of narrative, and then you start having to go, right, what do we have to let go?
Yeah, exactly. There are certain things. I mean, speaking of Anzio, you know, while I was researching it, there was this. Oh gosh, now I'm going to forget the name, but there's a story of a ranger company that tried to kind of strike out for Manzio, and they ended up getting basically baited out and almost completely wiped out. But then there were these really interesting stories of they took over a German tank and then managed to take out some other tanks, but then they got taken out by their own, you know, that tank got taken out by their own guys. And it was this really interesting battle. There just wasn't really a way to represent that, you know, without making it entirely its own thing. And there wasn't a way that I could bring that in. I mean, this was a huge theater. And when you're thinking about every theater, I mean, there's so many stories, right? Just stories of things that happened and that we've learned. And sometimes you have to say, ah, you know, we just can't find a way to bring that into it. So yeah, we've got to focus on what we can accomplish in that time and stay true. But yeah, there are some things that we had to leave behind because it would make the mission last 3 hours or something like that, and just wouldn't make sense for the context.
Folks, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you in a moment. Welcome back. I'm talking about Company of Heroes 3 with David Milne. It is an enormous, the Mediterranean Theatre is enormous, and you've been really focusing on Italy. So how different is the gameplay between Italy and North Africa?
So in North Africa, we're telling more of a linear story. So I was talking about how we had that grand strategy kind of campaign map. In North Africa, you're playing just mission one, mission two, mission three, mission, you know, you're kind of going through it in a more linear fashion. In terms of gameplay, you know, the maps themselves are quite open. In certain cases, the faction for the Africa Corps that you play as, they have access to a lot of vehicles, a lot of light vehicles, a lot of early tanks and stuff. So you're able to, the maps are quite a bit bigger and you're able to move around much more quickly and, you know, engage with kind of British kind of static defenses and try to get around them. And so it's a much more, I would say, mobile gameplay in North Africa than Italy, which has, of course, you know, river crossings and mountains and valleys and that kind of stuff that you're sort of fighting through. And so the tone of that gameplay changes quite a bit once you get to North Africa.
So this game is the map scale largest to allow for more movement?
In some cases, yeah. The maps for Gazala, Tobruk and El Alamein are all pretty big and pretty open. And what's breaking them up is sort of British, you know, the trench lines and stuff. You know, Tobruk in particular had this ring of trenches and defenses all around it, which I discovered you can still see on Google Earth. You can see the little box defensive zones that they had. They look like little ovals with zigzag slit trenches in them. And you can still see, if you look at Tobruk, you'll be able to see the trench line, the tank, first off, the tank ditch that they dug, and then the box defenses that they put behind it. You can still see it. And so that's what I based the British defenses off in Tobruk. I just took pictures of it and based it on that. And so even though it's quite open, you know, the aspect of Tobruk is that they actually have this pretty significant line that they're holding. And so you need to, you know, first what you're doing is actually trying to break through that line and then get in as quickly as you can to the city itself. The mission in our game is based on the second battle where it went actually quite quickly. It is quite open in North Africa and we're able to take a bit of a different tone to the gameplay.
And when you think about North Africa, I mean, how do you, because I assume at some point you're playing AI, if you're playing solo, you're playing AI. And how difficult, because I presume as well in that instance you're fighting against the Italians and the Africa Corps. Is there a nationalistic style that you have to sort of give them to do different things, I think is the way I'm trying to say.
We don't actually have a distinct Italian faction. It's the Africa Corps. And then how I was talking about how within the faction you have these battle groups you can choose. Like the Americans had the you know, the paratroopers and the armor and the special forces. The Africa Corps has two Italian battle groups that you can choose. And so one is kind of an elite infantry group. I'm going to butcher the name, Bersaglieri. they have the they have they're the guys that have the feathered hats, and they're these elite infantry. And then there's more of a support one where you have the Guastatori, which are the Italian sappers who have flamethrowers, and the Semovente, which is some of their tank destroyers and such as well. So we don't treat them as separate factions just because we just didn't have the capacity to make them a faction all their own, basically. But we definitely try to incorporate the Italians into that faction as much as we can, because they were also there. Like they were fighting. It wasn't all the Germans fighting there. So,
I mean, do you even worry about giving specific national AI when you're to the opposition?
In terms of like behavior?
Yeah.
We focus behavior more on a unit basis, because that unit will have kind of a job to do, right? So like the Semovente is, it has that fixed forward gun, and it's more about kind of destroying enemy vehicles. So its job is to kind of hang back a bit, act as that mobile anti-tank defense. And so like that's kind of what we focus on when it comes to the AI is the units themselves performing the specific job that they need to perform. An HMG needs to cover an area. Assault infantry will be pushing forward to try to recapture territory and attack you where they can. So that's more kind of how we focus on it.
Is there an enormous kit list for every? I mean, the kit list for this, did you have just a handbook of kit?
Yes.
For each?
Yes, there's a lot. There's a lot of abilities. There's a lot of weapons and tanks and, even just the British infantry section, the Tommy section, we kind of refer to it as, has three upgrades. You can give them a recon package, which gives them two scoped infields and a flare to call in artillery. You can give them boys anti-tank guns, which is kind of, a more anti-light tank rifle. Yeah. Or just a Bren gun to make them more anti-infantry focused to kind of help hold a line. So, and I mean, that's one unit. that has those three options, right? On top of the rifle grenades, smoke grenades, and infields that they already carry just by default. So yeah, there's a lot of weapons that we're representing in the game.
I was just thinking about the units. So you've got Italian units, the German units, you've got Indian units, you've got British, you've got American, Canadians.
So there are Canadian units in Ortona.
Anzacs?
Yeah. So they...
Australians and New Zealanders as well?
There's Aussies in North Africa as well, yeah. So, and that's something that's... You've pointed out something. That's actually something that we wanted to focus on as well, is kind of show how multinational this war was. You get a lot of representations, I think, that make it seem like it's America versus Germany, and that's really not the case. And it's not, even when it comes to the British forces, it's it's not just people from the island, it's from all over the Commonwealth. And so wherever we kind of had an opportunity to, we really tried to bring in different nationalities, as much as we possibly could, to make it feel like a world war, because it was a world war for a reason. It's because everybody was involved. So we want to try to reflect that as much as we can.
I think that's great. It's good to point this out to people. As you said, do you have French? Did you manage to? I was trying to think of who you could or couldn't shoehorn in. You're starting to push the boundaries when you're putting the French.
Yeah, no, currently no free French forces, but yeah.
When you're looking at North Africa, does it sort of start in 1940, 41? Actually, we later than that, we're 41 with the Africa Corps arriving, and it runs all the way through to what, El Alamein, and you're playing your way across.
So yeah, we start at Ajdabia, which is 1942. The Africa Corps has been pushed back a little bit, and then they're on their
so you're
secondary.
After first Tobruk.
Yes. Yes.
So that's hence they're coming back on the
and then they're pushing forward again. So yeah, that's what our focus is. Although one of the sub kind of plots we have going on there, it actually focuses on some of the civilians who are living in North Africa, a Jewish Berber family, during all of this. So there's focus on like what the DAC is doing, but then also how civilians are kind of reacting to this and to German occupation, and even having to send some of their own people to fight with the British and wanting to join up and stuff. And so that's an aspect that we wanted to they want to focus on as well, you know.
So how does that work? Because that's quite an unusual thing. You're usually in games, civilians are just often just non-existent.
So yes, so
they're just not there.
We actually, so there's kind of two ways that civilians are represented in our game. There are actual models in the missions of civilians. They are non-combative. You can't target them. We don't let that happen. But we want to make it feel more alive. There are civilians, you know, once fighting starts, they'll kind of run away and sort of trying to remind the player, you know, this is a world war and these were fought, you know, around people's homes and disrupted people's lives. And then in the North African campaign, it's really represented more in cinematic. So like kind of non-playable story sections where we're telling the story of this family. And so you kind of get the two sort of sides of what's going on there. Again, we want to focus on that human element, and we're trying to focus on the emotion of what's happening here, and trying to focus on character and the people themselves. And so we felt that was a way to kind of bring, I guess, you know, the story home with the effect that war can kind of have, you know, on the people who are living there.
How difficult was that to put together? I'm just trying to run through in my head.
Very difficult.
The sort of historiography. They really don't get much of a mention.
This is where we did work with consultants to make sure that we're telling a story that is accurate and authentic, and making sure that we're not misrepresenting things, because, you know, we definitely don't want to walk down that road. And yeah, they put a lot of work in and worked with some sort of external consultants to make sure that we were getting the right story there. I don't want to spoil too much of it here, and you know, I want players to play it, but yeah, there is that element of it as well.
It's funny because if you think about the historiography of the Italian campaign, the people of Italy get mentioned all the time, and the partisans and this, that, and the other. But sure, in North Africa, they never get a mention. And the only mention I could possibly think of is Lawrence of Arabia, and that's the wrong war.
Yeah. We found accounts and we're trying to represent that. Actually, speaking of partisans, I can't believe I didn't forget that there are partisans in Italy. There's partisan faction. You can sort of help them and recruit them to sort of fight with you. You can find partisan cells on the map, and they'll work to disrupt German logistics and stuff.
So you don't play the partisans. You activate partisans,
yes,
to work for,
yes,
you.
To work with you. They might not want to if you bomb all their buildings, but...
So otherwise it could be a bit asymmetric if you're playing the partisans for quite a while.
Yeah, it would be a bit tough in that case. But yeah, they act as sort of an allied faction that you can sort of gain the support of, but you can also lose the support of as well. If you're going through and just carpet bombing every single city, they're not going to be super jazzed about that, we'll say. So
that's a fantastic, that sort of morality layer to the game is absolutely fascinating, because it's not something I would have thought people have added in 20 years ago.
That's something we wanted to focus on as well, as on that grand strategy layer, that choices you make matter. They have benefits, certainly, but there is also possibly costs to the decisions that you make, and gaining or losing support of certain allies, gaining or losing access to certain things. One of the ways you can take over a city is just by bombing it into dust, but then you don't really get access to it. You have to spend a lot of time repairing it first, you know, so as opposed to going in and fighting the battle for it, and kind of gaining control that way. So there are certainly, how are you going to approach this? What is your choice here that we're giving the player?
So I assume you're getting, I presume it's available for the PC, and I presume it's getting released. Is everything released via Steam nowadays?
Yes, Steam is the PC platform.
And is it a wider release elsewhere?
Yeah, so we're releasing on consoles as well. That'll be coming soon. And so there's going to be, you know, there's just going to be a much larger audience who's going to be able to play this game. You know, this has always traditionally been a PC focused series, and so now that we're coming onto console, it's just, we're excited. A lot more people are going to be able to play this, get their hands on it.
Yeah, playing it on a console, you'll be able to watching your 64-inch TV, it'd be cool. David, thanks for joining me, folks. Next time out, I'll be looking at the German attempts to supply Stalingrad by air, and as a bonus episode following that, I'm going to be looking at Undaunted Stalingrad, a board game, to further explore how that represents the war. So until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Jerry 88 millimeter gun hit our tongue and blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.